southwest, but the southeast keeps the drier weather for Sunday too. We could see gale force gusts in the west for Sunday though. That's how it's looking.
Thanks very much, Sarah. Now on BBC Radio 4, The Last Asylum by Barbara Taylor. In the early 1980s, the author experienced a serious mental breakdown, a period of what she called madness, which led to her spending some 8 months in hospital. During this time, she continued to see her psychoanalyst, the man she calls V, and slowly, with the support of friends, a network of day centres and the hostel she stayed in, she gradually began to find her way back to an active life. The reader is Maggie Steed.
March 19, 1990. I am sitting in the waiting area before my session, buzzing with eager anticipation. V comes out of his room onto the stair landing and looks down to where I am sitting. Come up, please. I go up, enter, lie down. We talk. After a time, his words start to grate on me. My excitement darkens. Why was I looking forward to seeing him? Everything he says is inane, beside the point. He's a blundering idiot. I feel myself going rigid with rage. I want to kill him, to tear him up. I hear my voice go tight and shrill. I think I am going to vomit with furious disappointment. Why? Suddenly the question rises in me like an interrogative belch. I lie, without speaking, for a very long time. I hear cars passing by, V breathing quietly behind me. The tree across the street flaunts its springtime leaves, tender baby greenery. Gradually my body loosens. I feel the tears coming. So strange, all this is.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, I think so. Changing is very strange.
Change? Am I changing? Yes, you know, I think maybe I am. You know, I think maybe you are saving me. I think you are saving my life.
Well, we are saving your life.
Yes, we.
It's time.
My daily rhythms changed. Leaving Pine Street at closing time, I no longer went to my friend Anna's house, but instead returned to the hostel and placed myself in front of the TV. I bought takeaway dinners for myself. I love Chinese roast duck. A Chinese takeaway around the corner from the hostel did a very good roast duck. Once a fortnight, I went and bought some. Then 1 week, I bought roast duck on Monday and again on the following Saturday. Too much. When I told V, he laughed. So much duck. Who knows, maybe you'll even start enjoying life. I laughed too, and again felt the sensation of moving over to admit him. I know you're here, I told him. Freon closed on the 1st of April, 1993. It was a rush at the end, with a few patients still there on 31st of March. Remaining staff immediately began dismantling the hospital. 400 beds and mattresses were shipped to Sudanese hospitals. In 2004, when I was refurbishing a house, I bought several meters of oak floorboards from a salvage company. I asked the salesman if he knew their provenance. They're from an old mental hospital up in Freon Barnet. We've sold loads of them. At the end of 1995, the main building and 30 acres of grounds were purchased by Comer Homes, a property development company specializing in historic conversions. Freon has been erased. The fine old library is gone. The hospital chapel is now a gym. The graveyard for pauper lunatics has been obliterated, bar one small burial stone.
All that remains to show that this was once England's premier lunatic asylum is the 1849 plaque commemorating the laying of the foundation stone, which now graces the glitzy reception area outside the gym. Today, the old asylums are history. Their former residents are back with their families, or living in group homes or social housing, or they have vanished into the netherworld of the urban homeless. Like the asylums in their heroic foundational phase, community care arrived on a tide of transformative optimism. Assisted by the new drugs, people with mental disorders would shake off their outcast status to become normal or near normal family members, workers, and citizens. People in crisis would still receive hospital care in psychiatric wards inside general hospitals, but only until their conditions stabilized. No more long-term sequestration in institutional ghettos. In 2006, the UK Department of Health initiated a website, Our Choices in Mental Health. Launching the site, which is now defunct, a DOH spokesperson declared that patients should know that they now have the powers to choose their own paths through services and keep control of their lives. The following year, the government introduced Community Treatment Orders, CTOs, which compel people to take medication under threat of hospital detention if they refuse. CTOs, it was said, will be imposed infrequently and on a short-term basis. In fact, in the 3 years after they were introduced, 14,295 people were placed under CTOs, of which over 70% were still in force by the end of that time period. Black people figure particularly prominently in these figures, making up some 15% of the CTO population, as compared to 2.9% of the general population. Today, the majority of psychiatric inpatients are in hospital under legal compulsion. One of the most disheartening things I discovered during my research for this book is that the taking of patients' histories, so long a key feature of clinical psychiatry, is disappearing. It was Dr. D who first told me this. What you get mostly now are lists of symptoms and recent treatments, hardly any personal information. I ask about the patient's family, whether they have any children, what jobs they have had. Nobody knows. All they care about are symptoms. Nobody tries to get to know the person overall. Without history, people disappear. Unique identities that have taken shape over a lifetime are dissolving into generalities. Individuals are becoming diagnostic categories, risk profiles, crisis plans. The personal past often weighs heavily on people with mental disorders. Lightening that burden by revealing it, understanding it, sharing in it, is a vital part of mental healing. A psychiatric system that denies this to people needs to take a hard look at itself, to ponder its own refusals and deficiencies before setting out to remedy the ills of others. What would happen to me were my difficulties of 3 decades ago to occur today? My main treatment of choice was a privately funded psychoanalysis, and this option is still open to anyone who can afford it, although the numbers doing so are apparently dwindling. But if I broke down in the course of my psychoanalysis, as I did then, would I receive the help I needed? The complicated answer involves crisis teams, acute wards, recovery strategies, care plans, a constellation of services that operate fairly well in some parts of the country and much less well in others. Maybe I would be lucky. The simple answer relates to what I needed most. asylum, a safe place to be, a stone mother to hold me for as long as I required it. This I would not get. Frearn, the day hospital, Pine Street, all these, and havens like them, are gone. Would I make it? Possibly, especially if I managed to avoid involuntary detainment and treatment or long-term drugging. But it would be a tough call. The mental health system I entered in the 1980s was deeply flawed, but at least it recognized needs for ongoing care, for asylum, for someone to rely upon when self-reliance is no option. Needs that the present system pretends do not exist, offering, in their stead, individualist pieties and self-help prescriptions that are a mockery of people's sufferings. In 1996, I fell in love with a close woman friend who also fell in love with me. This was a happy surprise to us both, as neither of us had ever been sexually involved with a woman before. But no surprise to V, or so he claimed. "There have been hints of this," he said to me complacently. "My lover, my civil partner, as she now is, has two lovely sons, so now I find myself with a family." 7 years later, I published my book on Mary Wollstonecraft. I gave a copy to V. "Do you think you'll ever read it?" "Of course." I felt my eyebrows go up, but he didn't see this. A few months later, V and I parted. 27th July, 2003. Here I am, for the very last time. Here to say goodbye to this man who has changed my life. As I enter, I look at him, and I see that on this momentous day, this final day, after 21 and a half years, V looks and sounds precisely as he has always looked and sounded. Cool, professional. It could be any bloody session on any damn day. I could be anyone. It is unbearable. I flounce onto the couch and sulk furiously. But after a bit too much of this, I give up and let the sadness come through. I cry for a while, and we chat about this and that. The rose bush I gave to him earlier in the week. My summer plans. I feel the clock ticking towards closure. "You know what I'm doing this evening?"
"What are you doing?"
"I'm dining with a priest and a psychoanalyst."
"This is true."
"Well, so you've got your bases covered."
"Yes."
"You're telling me you can manage perfectly well without me?" "Perfectly well might not be the phrase you want."
"Oh, ever the pedant."
"Well enough, then. Will that do?"
"Yes. Well enough."
"Good. It's time."
Maggie Steed was reading from The Last Asylum by Barbara Taylor. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4.
Thank you.
And now the shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 22nd of February 2014. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Atsira, Forties, Cromartie, Forth, Tyne, Dogger, Thames, Dover, Wight, Biscay, Fitzroy, Sole, Lundy, Fastnet, Irish Sea, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low Bailey, 965, expected 150 miles north of Viking, 977, by 1800 Saturday. New low expected just west of Bailey, 966, by the same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, North Atsira, southerly or southwesterly, 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8. Rain or squally showers, moderate or good.